Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 26th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Muslim-Christian Dialogue, Is It Useful? Our presenter is Nellie Van Dorn Harder. Session number VAN 2006-1. Let's listen in.
Well, thank you all for coming to what is, seems to be called one of America's finest balls. I'm very impressed that you are here after such a long day at Holden and willing to engage in this topic that I find more and more difficult, of Muslim-Christian dialogue. But I went to Melissa's workshop this morning on making a play for theater, and she says the more inconsistency between characters, the more clashes, the better the play. So, and from this I took a lot of courage for my field. As you might know, my name is Nellie Van Dorn Harder. I am teaching at Valparaiso University. I teach world religions and Islam. And, I'm in a double-privileged place now, not just in a bowling alley, but my boss is even here, Fred Niedner. And I was thinking through this week how we would set it up when they asked me to come talk about Islam and about Muslim-Christian relations. And, of course, just the fact that Holden Village wants to talk about that shows that something might be good or wrong. Right? The fact that they say, well, we should really discuss this topic and ask someone who has studied about this whole issue, that must make us think. So I thought, why don't we start about dialogue, this Muslim-Christian dialogue? Why don't we just, because the idea of this week, I don't know if you have chances to come on other times too, but the idea is to look at basically what is happening in the world, and what has happened this last year, and where are we as Christians or as believers, or I'm not sure if all of us are Christians who are here. Is there anybody who's not a Christian or of another faith? So I could say, where are we as Christians? What do we do with this? Where does this place us? How are we called upon by what is happening in the world? Because if I look at the picture, think back in dialogue, Muslim-Christian dialogue, think about the 1980s. Oh, everything was so fine. And grand books were written, and Elsa, where are you again? Elsa just told me she had read a book in a course by Paul Mitter. All kinds of books were written about pluralist religion, and that maybe Christianity is not the only path, and that we should be more inclusive and more tolerant, and so forth and so forth. And Christians started to study deeply, not necessarily other faiths, but their own scriptures, to see what can we make of this, where does this put us, can we talk with others, where do we place other religions. And actually we made a huge step forward. And of course, I always mention this for those of you who was here, apart from Elsa, who was here last year at this lecture, because I always have to mention, it all started when we lost the mission fields. You know that, right? When you think about them, especially what I call middle of the road churches, which we are, Lutherans, Presbyterians, not the evangelical fundamentalist minded missionaries that go out still today, but the middle of the road churches. When our mission has completely changed since the last 30, 40 years, we had to, instead of going out and converting, we are going out to help, to assist. We are reacting and responding to what others ask us to do. And we have to, in the meantime, we have to reflect on our own attitude. We also, I must say so, have come to the conclusion, and that is why we especially talk about Islam, that there is no conversion possible in the Muslim world. If you think about the mission in Egypt, for example, a Muslim country, the most souls converted were converted from the indigenous Orthodox Church to the Protestant Church or to the Catholic Church. Very, very few Muslims were converted. there might be a lot of Muslims who became open to the Christian message but never converted openly, because the consequences are enormous for a Muslim in most of the Muslim countries. There is one big exception, that's Indonesia. Indonesia has freedom of religion, which means you can move, you can become, as being born a Muslim, you can move to Buddhism, you can move to Hinduism, you can move to Christianity. And this immediately answers the question to you, why do we see Indonesia on the front page so much these days? Right? Have you noticed how much Indonesia, which people used to think was you know, part of San Diego, how much it's on the front page nowadays? Why? Because there is a huge battle going on for the soul of Islam. And that is why extremist Muslim groups have targeted that place, because you can convert there, you can be free with choice of marriage partner. And Hinduism and Buddhism are two religions officially accepted by the states, while they are forbidden in most of the Middle East. So this is just to show you the picture, that we were missionaries, we were full of zeal and zest, and we realized this is not working, we have to change our tone, we have to change our methodologies, and what are we going to do with these others? And then these others also started to move from the Muslim countries to our countries, especially in the States, and since the 1960s, we have an enormous influx of Muslims from Pakistan, from India, and of course by the end of the 70s when the Iranian revolution took place, from Iran. And so we have an immense traffic towards our borders of Muslims who are settling here and who then have to come to terms with us, and we have to come to terms with them. Now, do I make sense so far? In my classes and wherever I speak, you can easily and as often as you want interrupt me. If you have a question or you can't follow me, let me know, okay? Or if you say, whoa, this really triggers a thought in my head, I want to say something, go ahead. Because I hope that that this will not be me just pouring out things on you, but that we will be able also to discuss this issue. This is something that needs a lot of discussion. Because we were in a process of making something new, and I come back to that. We revised our stand on mission. Then came the 70s and the 80s, and people like Paul Nitter started to write books about where do we stand, what can we do with our Christian message towards the non-Christian world. World Council of Churches has a huge department for interfaith dialogue, especially Muslim-Christian dialogue. And the Lutheran World Federation, as you might know, also has a special section for interfaith dialogue, and it had a special project the last 3 years on Muslim-Christian dialogue. And so the groups, if you actually Google, if you Google Lutheran Church and you put in interreligious or interfaith, you get tens of thousands of hits. Did you know that? There is a lot going on for those of us who is not Lutheran in this company. Okay, what are you?
UCC.
Oh, lots of dialogue in UCC too, right?
Oh, yes. And,
yeah, UCC as well.
Catholic.
Oh. Many dialogues in the Catholic Church, because Paul Nitter is a Catholic, if I'm not mistaken, right? Yeah, so so what do we see? We see an increasing number of activities from our side, so to speak, from the West, from Christians. What do we see on the Muslim side? Do we know about that? You shake your head.
I don't know.
You don't know. I thought you shook your head for another reason. Do we know what is happening on the Muslim side concerning Muslim-Christian dialogue?
There's a little bit.
There's a little bit, right. There's a little bit. Well, what do you know about?
I have a friend who's working on a documentary on monks from Algeria that were killed in 1999.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So they were involved in a very interesting but local dialogue.
Right.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, remembers the monks from Algeria? No. The monks, were they white fathers?
They were Trappists.
Trappists who were murdered in the Algerian, the fight between the Algerian extremists and basically the civil war in Algeria, and refused to leave. By the way, they refused to leave. They were asked. Rome had asked them to leave. They didn't want. They said, "This is our mission. We stay." And so this brings us back of something I hope we can also have time to talk about, you know, the role of being a witness. How far do you go in witnessing? But let us come back to the Muslim world. In the Muslim world, there are a lot of initiatives like you mentioned, small initiatives like people who really are deeply embedded and say, this is my call, and they actually have a very important influence. Their work is very, very important. And this is very long-term work. They stay often in their countries or in the countries where they are, and they set up huge circles and networks of Muslims and non-Muslims that do things together. So that happens. But my question was also, what about the Muslims? What do they, how do they consider interfaith dialogue? Do you know about that? Any of us who knows about that? Elsa, did you learn about that?
A little bit.
Yeah? What did you learn?
Well, I mean, there's just as within Christianity, there are a lot of different opinions, but in general, Muslims see Christians as people of the book, and so we have a partial revelation, and so we're still to be treated well.
Right.
Unlike Buddhism and Hinduism, which are pagan religions. So that's why Indonesia would be a hotspot.
Right, right. Buddhism and Hinduism are not in the Quran. They're not mentioned in the Quran. And that's why they cannot be counted as valuable and valid religions. Christianity and Judaism is mentioned in the Quran. Everybody knows what the Quran is, right? The holy book of the Muslims. Those are mentioned in the Quran. However, they are mentioned as people with a certain status. What is the status? They had a revelation, but they changed the revelation. They changed their original books, and these original books are now being corrected by Islam. The message, the final message of the Prophet Muhammad, corrected both Judaism and Christianity. And so it's the final message, it's the last revealed message, and it's the best message, and the direct word of God. That's another part, which is considered the direct word of God. Now, what does that do to a Muslim mindset? To a Muslim mindset, it means that, okay, you can tolerate these people, but in the end they should be converted. For example, the myth about the last day, the last judgment is the Muslim, you know, end time story is that Jesus will come. Well, first the Antichrist will come. Then Christ will come. He will fight with the Antichrist, and he will, of course, be victorious. And then he will pray following the Muslim prayer leader. So Christ will reveal himself as having been a Muslim all along. Yes. And then the Christians will, the shells will drop from their eyes, and they will then all become Muslims and die as Muslims. If it's not too late, though, but that's another story. But you see what we are looking at. We are looking at us who, for the longest time, you know, stuck to the word from the Bible. But Jesus also told us, don't believe anybody who has any other message coming after me. That's a false prophet. Don't believe that, right? But we have somehow started to contextualize that message. We have started to analyze it, and we have started to reinterpret. While most Muslims are not there yet. They are not there yet if they ever want to get there. You see? For them, Christianity and Islam are minor, saying it in a bad way, defective. We are defective religions that have to be corrected. Corrected. Now, what do we see in real life? What do we see in real life? We see all these Muslims going all over the world. We see them go to Europe. And of course, if I say the things that happened lately, what do you think about when I say Europe?
France.
France, right. Burned cars, suburbs, upside down.
The cartoon controversy.
Cartoons from where again?
Denmark.
I'm going to talk about that day after tomorrow.
Oh.
And but, you know, it's just one thing after the other that's coming at us, right? And then you go, and then here, what if you think about Islam here, what would you hear? Or do you hear anything?
I don't know.
What?
Criticism that they're not speaking out enough against violence.
Criticism that they're not speaking out enough against what happened 9/11 and so forth, yeah?
Or they're funding terrorists.
They're funding terrorists and so forth and so forth. Right. Now, if you look at the Muslim community as a whole in Europe, here. Now, so we move now from the Middle East, from the Muslim countries here to the West. And we look at what do most Muslims do. Then we see that 60-70% have become quite secular. These mosques seem packed and overflowing. Why? Because there are not as many as there are churches. You know, you go to France, the mosques are packed. Why? Because first of all, they are places to create networks. Secondly, they're places where you might find a job. They might help you find a job. Thirdly, there are thousands of empty cathedrals in France, but only a handful of mosques compared to the number of Muslims that are there. Does that really skew your vision? But if you really go around and you interview Muslims and you talk to Muslims, then you have just as many layers of being Muslim as we have as being Christian. There are Muslims who become secular, Muslims who still believe a little bit in the Quran, Muslims who take something from the Quran, Muslims who, you know, who do kind of say, well, yes, I'm a Muslim, which means I want to be buried as a Muslim when I die, and so forth and so forth. You have a huge spectrum of being Muslims. And again, this answers your question. What about all these fundies that we see going raging around the world? You see, they have a battlefield in front of them. A huge battlefield of Europe, of America, where Muslims are falling off the face. And what does that do for us, to our Muslim-Christian dialogue? Because the problem is this, that we are facing, that these people who are a little bit Muslim, like in Holland you have now a lot of people who are no longer a little bit Christian, they are a little bit something. And if you ask them, what are you something? Well, I believe in something. Okay, like when the house collapses in an earthquake, you suddenly believe in something. Yeah, kind of that. Okay. You know, that is that. So you have more and more Muslims who are a little bit Muslim, who just, you know, they want their children to learn the five pillars. We all know the five pillars, right? Everybody knows that?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry if I bore you, those of you who know the five pillars, but it's like, you are a Muslim if you believe that there is one God and that Muhammad is his prophet. If you believe, if you practice the rule of Ramadan, that you fast during Ramadan, if you pay your so-called zakat, which is charity, which is a part of your income, you clean your income. If you can afford it, you make the Hajj to Mecca, you make the pilgrimage to Mecca once in your life. And of course, what makes you most of all visibly a Muslim is if you pray five times a day in the mosque. Now you go to Cairo, who prays five times a day in the mosque? Almost nobody but extremists, youngsters who have nothing else to do and want to make a huge show of force. Did you notice that too, Elsa? And then on Friday they make an extra show of force. They call in the troops because they want to, you know, give this impression Islam is so strong and so important and so growing. So that is what makes you a Muslim. If you follow these five pillars, then you can say I'm a practicing Muslim. Of course, the fact that you believe in God and in the Prophet Muhammad means that you believe that the Quran is the final and ultimate and sole word of God. You believe that everything that's in that Quran is from God. Of course, and we're not going to talk about that. Does anybody know where that attitude comes from towards the Quran? Torah, Orthodox Jews. That's what the Prophet Muhammad knew. Orthodox Jews who will not change one dot in the Torah and in the Hebrew, because that's a sin. That's where he took it from. But, you know, of course, that's all historical deconstructionism that you cannot speak out loud of in the Muslim world. And when you do it, you have to go into exile. Because some people do it, but they are in a difficult place. So you see, we're looking at two very different mindsets. We're looking at a mindset, our mindset, when you say, that's why I talk about middle of the road Christians, because a very evangelical, fundamentalist minded Christian has a very different mindset from what most of us have, if I'm if I'm reading the audience correctly, right? So we have that mindset that says, yes, we should look at the message of Jesus, but we should look at the message of justice, the message of love, the message of hospitality, the message of feeding the poor. That is what Jesus meant. And you didn't, and Jesus never asked, right? Are you a Muslim, Christian, Jew? He never did that. You know, remember, we look at the Samaritan woman, the parable of the Samaritan woman. That is what you focus on. And then you read more in the Bible and you see in the Acts, you see the story of Cornelius, right? With that all who follow the way of God are included in the kingdom of God. And of course, I think, did you point that out in your sermon that Cornelius then eventually did convert to become a Christian? I was involved wondering. There was a trick in the story. In the end, you know, he does become a Christian. But we read the Bible like that. Many of us no longer read it literal. And then we are looking at Muslims who read it very literal, who call the shots. And that's very important to remember too. The Muslims who read the Quran very literal are the ones who make the news, are the ones who publish, are the ones you hear about. The Muslims, the 60% I'm talking about, who are a little bit Muslim, most of them don't dare to speak up. Because it is all very risky, especially if you are in the Middle East, or because they don't have the knowledge to defend their thoughts. Because you need to be like a Muslim theologian or a philosopher to really defend what you believe in. So that's what we're looking at. And so we already, the whole picture of how the world is being presented to us is very lopsided. And that is why opinion polls, maybe you heard about them, you know, in America, there was an opinion poll the other day by the Washington Post where almost 50% of the Americans looked extremely negatively at Islam. Did you read about that poll? No. We had the same poll in the Netherlands. It was the same result. Now, the people who were not so negative, you know why they were not so negative? They knew someone. What did you? They knew. There was a taxi driver from Chicago, I remember. He said, oh, I have this Muslim neighbor, and I'm on good terms with him, and we're fine. And so he was not so, his opinion was much less negative. So if we say, you know, about Muslim-Christian relations, we have this whole... This whole exercise of opening up ourselves with starting all kinds of initiatives for Muslim Christian, for relations with Muslims. And now what we are seeing is that we have this huge tidal wave coming at us of people who try to stop their own constituency, so Muslim extremists trying to stop other Muslims from actually conversing with us. That's what we're dealing at today. And that's why I say, is it still useful? Because when you have dialogue with someone who wants to have dialogue, you actually are preaching to the choir. So what you have to preach to is these people who don't want to talk to you. And I give you an example. The famous cartoon issue from Denmark, right? I'll tell you more about that in 2 days. But that was started by a very extremist leader. Did any of you follow how it started?
No.
In a very short, in a nutshell, it was started by Abu Laban, a Palestinian extremist Muslim leader in Copenhagen, who had been in Copenhagen since 25 years, doesn't know one word of Danish. I can testify to that because I've met Abu Laban when I visited him with the Lutheran World Federation committee. And I heard him preach. I've never heard so much hatred being spoken in Arabic, and he saw this cartoon issue as a way to gain influence in Denmark. Now, but what was interesting then whirlwind storm tornado that then came over the world, he also forbade Muslims who were connected in an institute in Denmark, in Copenhagen, there's an institute set up by the church that is the only interfaith institute so far in Denmark that has really tried to make connections between Muslims and non-Muslims. You can't say Christians in Denmark, you know that, right? It's, most of them are very, very, very de-churched or more. Anyway, but he started to actually forbid people who were involved in that project that really tried to calm down and pacify, you know, the different groups. He forbade them on a punishment of excommunication, although he can't excommunicate, but he forgot that, I guess, that they should no longer mix with the Danes. But think about it. Think about it. You're in the middle of this huge conflict. Don't you want to make some peace? So, yeah, for you, is it? I see Diane say, oh, no. Why not? Why not?
Well, because if you set a fire in order to gain adherence and support and attention, you don't want someone putting the fire out.
Exactly. You want it to make a bonfire.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to create a bonfire and as many flames as you can have. And you don't really care about destruction, about, you know, what that actually is going to mean for the community that is not behind you, even though they are devout Muslims, because there are a lot of devout Muslims in Denmark that are not extremists. Never mind that they might lose a job, never mind that they might lose their work permit, their, you know, residence permit. Denmark will probably kick them out. Never mind. You know, you want your group to show force and to lead the Muslim world. And so that is what we, well, what we are talking about. And I was actually, last week it must have been, at a conference of professors of missiology, and there Paul Nitter's book was discussed, and the conclusion was, it's no longer valuable. We can't do anything with those books anymore, those books that give us, you know, nice idealistic pictures. So where do we go on from that, from here? And before I go on, I will read to you a few things that I gathered here to give you an idea of what is in the Quran. Because if I say Muslims consider Christians as, let's say, secondary, and I don't even want to mention the Jews, you know, with Israel and everything. I mean, the whole Muslim world, including those Muslims who've never seen a Jew in their life, like Indonesia, have never seen a Jew in their life. Once we did research to the Jewish community in Indonesia, we found 11 families in Singapore, and that was it. But they hate them. They hate them with, you know, everything they can muster, because, of course, of Israel and Palestine, that issue. But now, here it comes. Are these extremists in the right? That's the question. Do they take their Quran seriously? Because what is in the Quran? And I will quote you one of the things that's in the Quran about the other. It says, people, we created you all from a single man and a single woman and made you into nations and tribes so that you should get to know one another. In God's eyes, the most honored of you are the ones most aware of him. God is all-knowing, all-aware. Shall I repeat it?
Sure. Yes.
People, we created you from a single man and a single woman. All Adam and Eve.
Yes.
Right? We too. And made you into nations and tribes so that you should get to know one another. Right? So the Quran gives many openings for getting to know others. And then it says, in God's eyes, the most honored of you are the ones most aware of him. Very similar like what the New Testament says about Cornelius. The people who are aware of God are the ones honored by God. He doesn't mention it's only Muslims. You see? It's people who have a God awareness. They are the ones who are liked by God. And God is all-knowing, all-aware. God knows who those people are. That's in the Quran. And then there's also something else in the Quran that says, if I would have wanted it, where God speaks, if I would have wanted it, I would have made you I would not have made you into many nations. I would have made you one nation with one faith. With other words, he didn't want that. So this is not what is happening. So you see, extremists read the Quran with certain shades over their eyes.
with a certain type of glasses, focusing on one type of discourse and not focusing on the other, and taking it out of context. Do you recognize what I'm saying? Okay, I don't have to say more, right? Because there is in the Quran, there are things, fight them till death. Who do they mean? They mean the opponents of the Prophet Muhammad. They don't mean Americans. But that's something else. It's too much contextualizing, you know, that just makes you dizzy. So you just read, fight them to death, and that's enough. And so that is what we are looking at. And then there's another thing I wanted to show you, because this whole attitude of finding the non-Muslims, let's say, I can almost say less human on the human, you know, ranking. Where does it come from? It comes from the first centuries of Islam. When Islam spread, handful of Muslims came out of Mecca and Medina, spread all over the Middle East, out to North Africa, on to Spain. You remember? Mm-hmm. Stopped at the south of France, that's scarily close by, or someone from the Netherlands. And, you know, that's where they defeated by the grandfather of Charles, whom we call Charles the Great. And the idea was this. It was not we want to spread the faith. No, the idea was we conquer. We conquer, and we have our book that says these people who are Jews and Christians can stay where they are as long as they accept our rule, as long as we can be their government. That was it. But then, you know, governments need clerics and translators, and so the local population started to mix with the Muslim rulers and started to work with them, and then the Muslims realized how scarily close Judaism and Christianity were in the message. Well, that's another topic, but there's a lot in the Quran that's taken especially from the Old Testament. And you know the Quran is a whole chapter on St. Mary, and it's just lots on Jesus. I think Jesus is the most mentioned prophet in the Quran in comparison with all the other prophets. So it had to draw lines. It had to discern itself, make itself different from the other religions. So that went much more, that went on the one hand through the system, and that was what we now know as the Sharia system, the legal system. It did not go through the philosophy, it went through the legal system, and it was, to me, as far as I can understand it, a psychological war, of a war like, I am better than you. It's like the Nazis ruling over the Dutch, you know, we're both from the same tribe originally, remember? How do you divide these two and say I should rule over you and you not over me, right? So that was the big issue. These people were all, let's say, Middle Easterners, and they were all more or less similar in practices, in attitudes. Women were mostly veiled in the Middle East. It was not Muslim. You know, that their whole idea of polygamy, everybody practiced it, even Christians. You know, and of course, that was not allowed. But it was something that was in the underlying culture. And later on, as they started to mix more and more, we read, for example, from the 17th century in Egypt, that a lot of Christians had second, third, fourth wives. And of course, the patriarch didn't like that at all, but that was too bad for him. You know, it was just this mixing of cultures. So then you have to draw lines. And in drawing those lines, as I see it, the battle was psychological. And it still is psychological. We are waging a battle of the minds, really. And so I want to read to you is a passage by Said Nursi, who is a Turkish Muslim leader. I don't know, has any of you ever heard about him, Said Nursi? Yeah? Who has heard about him? He has become extremely influential in interfaith activities that are started by Muslims from Turkey. And actually, in the Lutheran Seminary in Chicago, we have several Turkish students from the movement that was started by Said Nursi studying Christian theology.
So that is, so this, I'm talking about a very open-minded man, as you see, a very inspired man, a very mystically minded man. Now this is what he says about Islam. And he's speaking in a mosque. He's speaking in a mosque, and he says, do the introductory remarks. He's speaking to other Muslims. Do the introductory remark, that is, those made up here, not point to the conclusion that it is Islam that will be the true and spiritual ruler over the future, and only Islam that will lead mankind to happiness in this world and the next, and that true Christianity, stripping off superstition and corrupted belief, will be transformed into Islam, following the Quran. It will unite with Islam. Can you follow me? So he starts with saying that Islam, that in a way he says, okay, it's not just Islam that is the spiritual and true religion. However, the problem with Christianity is it's filled with superstition and corrupted beliefs. So in his total openness, he still goes back to these old teachings that Christianity has been corrupted. And so, in the end, he says Christianity will be transformed into Islam following the Quran, and it will unite with Islam. So, in a way, his whole idea of openness is to eventually, you know, make everything into one religion. And that is his religion. So this tells you a little bit about the mindset. And now I want to stop here for 1 minute to see if there are any questions or remarks you want to make. Yeah?
Just factual. What year did you say Islam spread into Western Europe? Like starting to around
then? 7th century. And by 731, 32, it was stopped in South France. It was like within a hundred years of the death of the Prophet Muhammad, who died in, was it 632? 632, right? Yeah. Within 100 years, they had spread all through the Middle East, North Africa, all the way to Sicily and France. Yeah. And stayed.
And it started exactly where in the Middle East?
Mecca and Medina, what is now Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that is where the Prophet Muhammad had his first call and his first revelation. Yeah. So that went very, very fast. And we all know why it went so fast, right? Do we know that? No? That is because that area was part, most of the area was part of the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire was constantly battling with the Persian Empire, the Sassanid Empire. And where did they meet? Where do you think they meet? The Roman Empire and the Persian Empire. What?
Egypt?
Yeah, kind of like more when now Syria, Jordan, you know, Israel, that's where they met. So that's where people were constantly run over, were living with enormous violence, and somehow were so tired of the violence that these Muslims were a breath of fresh air. So it was not negative in the beginning. It wasn't negative at all. And a lot of Christians actually saw that Islam was another Christian sect. That's what they thought. They didn't think this was a new religion. They thought, oh, this is just... You know, there were so many sects in the Middle East at that time, and there were so many misunderstandings about who was Jesus. That's again, I'm going on the track now, but you know, what was Jesus divine and human? Was he just human? Was he just divine? There was a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of quarreling going on about that, and also there was a lot of misunderstanding about the Trinity. And that's why we have in the Quran that the Trinity... Do we know the Trinity in the Quran? God, Jesus, and St. Mary. Makes full sense, right? Nice little family. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense to a simple Middle Eastern person from the early centuries. And so, and especially a Bedouin, my gosh, that this Trinity was so... So mystifying that they couldn't understand it. So that's why Muslims accuse us of believing in three gods, because you know that it's not the Trinity if we believe it. Okay, any other questions at this point? And I have to keep an eye on the time. Yeah.
On the Trinity, some scholars feel that the Trinity and the American political system also is a direct derivation of Sufi. It roots in Sufi, Islamic Sufi thought. And I can discuss that later.
Yeah, the Sufism came later than the Christianity.
Yes.
Thanks. Yeah. Now, so shall we now go on to this dialogue? Because that's one. So basically, what we're looking at is that people say we need to go into a new level. We need to look at new issues. The times that we just talk about faith and about religion and have nice conversations about what do you believe or what do I believe and what was Abraham to us, that time is actually over. So what do we need to do? And where do we look for models? That is a big question. And right now, we're almost in a vacuum. We're almost in a vacuum. And we're looking around the world and seeing, how can we do this? How can we do this? Because like colleagues from the Lutheran Seminary in Minnesota, they... what's his name now again? His wife works in Hong Kong. What's his name?
Mark Swanson?
No. No.
At the seminary.
Yeah, he said seminary too. No, never mind. He wrote, again, a report from the Lutheran World Federation that was led by someone from the seminary. This was their conclusion, like 10 years ago. We're stuck. We need to go on another level. But what should that level be? And for that, we are now looking around the world to find other models. And we're coming more and more to the conclusion that the model has to be much more based, of course, locally. Locally, and that's where you all come in, and where I come in, and where we all come in. We have to look at our local conditions, and then we have to research, is why doesn't it work, what we have been doing? Because often, there are these huge differences in economical situations. There are these huge differences in the social status of people. So it is really much more an issue of social justice than it is of religion. And that is also, when you go, for example, to Europe, there are, and that's why I brought this book by Pim Valkenberg. He's a Dutch Catholic theologian, and he has been at Notre Dame several times. Well, he said, he also describes how he just started all kinds of groups discussing, you know, the faith, what do you believe, what do we believe, and nobody came, no Muslim came. Why not? Because these Muslims needed to find a job, needed to learn Dutch, needed to find a house, and were wondering, how do I get my family to the Netherlands? Right? And so it's just, and so if we look, we look in every place and see what can we do? What is this group suffering from? And how can we reach each other? And we can learn from that when we look at places where Muslims and Christians have been in dialogue for many, many times. Because I'm sure many of you have dialogue in their local communities. Who has something of dialogue in their local communities? You have. See? Yeah. So can anybody tell us something about how that came about and what you're doing? Yeah?
Well, for example, on St. Olaf's College campus, we're starting a movement for interreligious action group, and there's a big focus on this, and not so much sitting down and talking, well, what do you believe, but rather going out and doing service projects together.
Right. Together, that's a very important word. Doing things together, seeing where's the need, and then realizing, oh, but we have this need too. Poverty is not only in the Muslim countries, it's here too. You know, injustice is spread all over the world. So how can you deal with that? And from that we can learn, for example, and I'm going to talk about that tomorrow, from Christians in the Middle East, like the Christians in Palestine, because how have they... they're only 2% of the population, less than 2%, 1.8 if I'm not mistaken. And still, they have an enormous ministry in Palestine. How do they do that? Does anybody know? I'm sure many of you know about the Palestinian ministries of the Lutherans, don't you? Who knows about it? Elsa Mose, you know? What?
Hospitals,
schools... Right? And not looking at what religion you are, but teaching the children and taking care of the sick and so forth and so forth. Now the question is, how do you translate that?
How do you translate that? Because our big issue remains, we are looking at an extremely polarized world where there are groups who want us to polarize. And it is up to us to break through that. And how do we do that? And I don't know, is any of you planning to come tomorrow?
Yes.
It's 10:45.
What time tomorrow?
10:45. And it's not here. It's in the fireside room in Koinonia, right? Because one of my questions for tonight was, if you can make it tomorrow, maybe you can think about it, maybe you can discuss it, because we have this week, we have all kinds of wonderful talks, and I had to unfortunately miss your talk, right? I want to call you Dr. Martin, but and your talk about the death penalty, and your husband's talks, right, about what does he call it, social action group, right? Building community from the inside out. And that's what we're talking about, you know? You have to start looking in your environment and say, how can I build a community from the inside out? And where do we learn that from? We learn that, for example, from Christians in Palestine, from Christians in Indonesia, from Christians in Egypt. And I thought it might be interesting for you to hear a little bit about that. Because how do, for example, the Christians in Egypt deal with the massive Muslim environment that where with these forces that want to polarize the environment, and then they also were the first to observe this polarization because they were being attacked. Has any of you heard about these attacks in Egypt? But how Christians are being attacked by Muslims over and over again by certain Muslim groups. Now, what do you do as a church? How do you stand up to that? What kind of methods do you apply? Does anybody have any idea? What would you do? First step, throw the true perpetrators in jail because they're criminals. Second step, see who wants to talk with you. Because that is still the big issue. Not everybody wants to talk with us. That see who wants to talk with you. So what they have looked at is, okay, what I said, these, where do issues touch each other? So they set up groups, discussion groups with youth. And that's why I'm very happy with Elsa's example. Because youth is really the motor where it starts. And, I mean, now you all have to feel youthful because nobody is excluded as far as I can see, okay? And so what did they do? They have looked at what are the problems that our youth face in Egypt. Well, those are universal. Nobody can marry before they're 50 because there are no apartments available. So they have these discussion groups about apartments. Second problem. Universal, Christians, Muslims, everybody suffers from it. Your mother-in-law who calls the shots till she dies and you are too old to enjoy life. So you have discussion groups about that. You see, no religion. No religion. You don't talk about religion. You talk about what is it that concerns us. How can we build this society? You move from religion to civic society. That's what you do. And that is what has worked enormously and amazingly, like the schools in Palestine. Egyptian Christians have opened schools. I don't know, did I mention those last year? They have opened schools that don't mention world religion. Everybody's welcome. And children only learn about ethics. Why should you be polite to each other? Why should you open the door? Why should you listen to people and to their opinion? And then in the middle, you know, you try to move in some ideas about that all people are made equal by God and so forth and so forth. And so that is what they try to do through youth, through the children, trying to change the mindset. What else do you try to do? Can you think of other things? You're in the Middle East. You have all kinds of trouble in your head. And life is not easy when you are living in Egypt. You know, It's hot like it is today, many times or hotter, and it's a big struggle to find a job, and you don't earn very much, most people don't earn very much. Can you think of other things that people can discuss? Yeah?
We have someone who, she's actually Palestinian Egyptian herself, and she went back and set up communities for women to do crafts instead of sell their crafts.
Right. Small projects that people can make a living wage. The loans, the small loans that, you know, the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh that has set up that system of small loans to people, mostly women, because focusing on women. Because women are often behind everything. It's the children, but it's also the women. They have a huge influence. How many women suicide bombers do we have so far?
Two.
And one is? Two, of whom one is? A Belgian.
Oh.
I'm sorry. It's still very puzzling to all of us how she could do this. But only two from the thousands of suicide bombers that we have had so far in the world. It's mostly not the women, you see. Women, that is what the Christians in Egypt realized too. Women still are very powerful weapons in deflating this whole movement. By not just by talking to their children, but also by trying to talk to their brothers, to their fathers, to their husbands, and so forth and so forth. So they have women groups. They have women projects, women groups, and strange enough, what is the main project that you find set up in Egypt? You will probably never think of it. Project to work on this against this polarization.
No.
Female circumcision.
Oh.
Yeah. Because that is the example of something that is put on religion, that is done in the name of Islam and in the name of Christianity, in the name of who knows what, but it has no basis neither in Islam nor in Christianity. So it can be completely taken out of its religious context and moved into healthcare for women, food, then you can bring the food in, because with the healthcare for women it comes out that they often are underfed and don't have enough, and so forth and so forth. So you see, this is the what people all over the world, and I'm so happy to hear that in St. Olaf students are also waking up to that, because from our side, of course, what is very important for our young people and for our students is to travel and to see the world and to see communities and to go, and I'm sure in your talks you have talked about that, to go to the areas where people are actually suffering and actually talk to them and give them a face. Because in the end, what is the root cause of this whole polarization? You know, the method of tearing communities apart is taking away their human face. That is the method. The method of making sure that nobody sees them as normal human beings made by God and, you know, like everybody else. That is how they do it. And that is how you get books written full of with titles like The Curse of Cain, The Violent Legacy of Monotheism, where they show that the root of this violence is to completely... focus on the message that you are better than the other and that the other actually can be eliminated. And of course, I don't have to say more than Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. That was the message. You know, you could eliminate the Jews because they were absolutely worthless and they were ruining your society anyway, and so forth and so forth. So that is what you have to battle. That is the greatest battle we are fighting against. And if we do, so if we now go back one more step from the projects, so we have gone from the traditional dialogue, from the more academic dialogue, from the more theoretical dialogue in comparing scriptures, then we went to projects. Now we go to the ultimate dialogue, which is peacemaking. And taking the methods of the peacemaking studies that we have learned from so far, how do you do that? And in a way, when you then turn it around, I think I have to stop almost, right? If I want to, because I don't want to keep you after such a long day. But if we then turn it around, you get from these peacemaking projects, we learn that from John Paul Lederach. Has any of you ever heard about him? He is a professor at Notre Dame, a Mennonite professor who has deeply studied, for example, conflict in South America. And what he found works is to open spaces. So go in a space, to move in a space where there is a certain neutral ground and where people can meet in the neutral ground and where they can, and that's, for example, as I say, the female circumcision is a neutral ground. And the women project is neutral ground. And that's what I was going to ask for those of you who want to come back tomorrow or later in the week. Think about it this week. What kind of neutral ground can you think about in your environment? And this is not just for Muslim Christian dialogue. It's for everybody who would love to, as we say in Dutch, stick behind the wallpaper. Right? Because don't we all have beefs with others? Right? It's not just Muslim Christian dialogue. It's in many ways in life that we should, that we have that. And so what we have come to see is that we have to go back to point zero and look at what we learned from the peacemaking studies. And from there start to develop new issues. And St. Olaf has the student projects. In Valparaiso University, we have now more and more classes that involve peacemaking studies in interreligious studies, that it goes up. And the students cannot pass in the class until they've gone out to neighborhoods, to mosques, to actually spoken. And since so far I have not managed to prove that they actually did it but wrote it down, I have now changed my methods. And the final result for my common class will be a little video. and I'm going to get help right here in Holden to think about how to do that and help the students, because then you cannot say, oh yeah, I'm nervous for because we have to become more intense. That's just the way it is, but more focused, more intense in being witnesses, basically going back to the basis of our message. We are witnesses of our message of Christ, of being open to the world and seeing how we can serve. And that is what I think. At this moment, maybe when I speak to you next year, I have another plan because this one failed. But we try. So we are really in a very interesting and very exciting phase of this whole Muslim Christian dialogue that we can all be in. And that's what I find. That's why I love to talk about it and why I put it back on the schedule this year, although I never like to talk twice about the same topic in the same place, because I hope that we all are finding things, you know, in our own environment and come up with plans and maybe share those plans. And maybe when we come back to Holden or through the Holden newsletter or through other ways, share those plans or hand them on to the Lutheran Church, to the seminaries, to St. Olaf, to Valparaiso University. There are so many places where we can continue developing these new ideas. Were you aware that we were in this revolutionary phase of history? Okay, yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment to back up. When you talk about religions basically drawing a line in the sand and defining themselves, having to differentiate themselves from others, that part of that one true religion notion, that when we're not on, when we as Christians are not on neutral ground, but in our own congregations, I'm thinking part of this revolution is for us to give up the notion of the Great Commission and the one true religion. I mean, we're killing each other, right? Like all of us, all these religions, claiming one true religion. So,
because I was surprised that nobody asked that yet. It's very important, because the question is, how can you do that without giving up your own Christian identity? That's a big question. Do you have to give up your Christian identity?
No.
I don't think so at all. I think the more, I mean, you know that most people in the Muslim world have prayed for me that I become Muslim. Unfortunately, I'm too stubborn to see life. you know? So you see,
I mean, but the more I've spoken with people about the faith and got to know their ideas, the more I turn to my scriptures and say, do we have that actually? And by speaking with Muslims and with also with many Christians in the Middle East, I completely rediscovered our own heritage of early fathers and mothers. And there's the fathers and mothers who have deep, deep thoughts about these things because they lived in a similar world. They lived in a time when Christianity was a minority. And actually, I love this one. This Holland, Netherlands, right, where I come from and where I still regularly go back to, they had a contest, the best sermon ever. I don't know, all time from the middle of Christianity. Guess who won? They listened to hundreds of sermons from pastors. Now they read sermons. Guess who won? And was on the front page of the Dutch newspaper. St. Augustine.
Oh!
So that shows us, you know, we can become excited by learning more about ourselves when we do this, and by seeing more how can I stand for my message in this world, instead of letting this all go and saying, okay, some people are polarizing us, too bad, I'm just withdrawing in my shell. We shouldn't do that. You know, we should stand up and say and think, we're not the first ones who live in a polarized world. It's always been like that, really. We just maybe thought for a while it wasn't that way. So thanks so much, Lisa, for bringing us.